Well, now, finally, on Saturday Extra, to a traveller's tale that combines your classic light travel itinerary, plus a cook's tour for Australians of the classics, plus some very deep thought indeed about search for meaning. The Melbourne sociologist John Carroll is the man who decided to bite into this cherry with a book called Greek Pilgrimage, In Search of the Foundations of the West. He believes all of us born into the West are Greeks at our core. But more than that, when there, he feels awed and in the presence of something timeless, like nowhere else he's visited. So I had to hear why. John Carroll, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Why bother with a trip like this, John?
Well, one of the reasons is that I'm intrigued by why we humans are so drawn to the past and to monuments, relics, and to certain places where we somehow imagine in some vague way that there's a truth there. There's a sort of, I think it's a sort of homecoming that we're yearning for somewhere in the significant past. And for me, and in many ways for everyone in the West, the biggest place where that happens is classical Greece.
Well, I wonder whether it does dominate many people's thoughts. Really, this is a sort of a real evangelising about how classical Greece is the source of all the Western canon, our Western values.
Well, if you were just to reflect, what's the biggest carnival in the world today? It's the Olympic Games, which is just a straight recreation of what the ancient Greeks did over 1,200 years in Olympia, with the sort of belief in a sort of secular religion in beautiful athletic performance, drawing people to the Olympic Games, drawing people to sport. That begins in classical Greece. If we look at any city in the Western world, we keep rebuilding images of the Parthenon, poor copies of that form of architecture. We're sort of unconsciously driven, whether we like it or not, to keep reproducing the forms that come out of this place. So I'm intrigued to go back, as I've done many times, to the actual Parthenon, to the actual Olympia, and to just sort of ponder on what's going on here.
Well, before we do dive in deep, let's describe, as you do at the back of your book, a 14 and an 8-day tour that the classic traveller could do. And for the purposes of radio brevity, maybe you could just very quickly take us through what a good inquiring traveller could achieve in an 8-day tour.
I think a couple of days in Athens, dominated by the Acropolis and its two buildings, the Parthenon and the Erechtheion, and a few other linked sites, followed by day three, a drive to Delphi. And Delphi is, for many people, including myself, the most magical place on earth they've ever been. It's where the Delphic Oracle was, obviously enough. There are plenty of ruins there, a very good museum. But there's a magic in the air, which the main reason for this book is
an eerie enchantment, you write?
An eerie enchantment, yes. The mystery of what is going on in this place, which should be dead to us. I mean, these are a series of meaningless, dirty bits of broken rock sitting on the side of a Greek hillside miles from anywhere of any interest. What is it that's going on? And to me, the argument in the book, it's the magic of culture, which is what gives us meaning in our lives. And to get meaning in our lives, we have to go back to the past, the significant past. And the argument here, of course, is the place of classical Greece in the significant past part of the West, to re-engage with whatever it is that emanates from places like Delphi.
And
from Delphi,
yes,
we move on to Olympia, beautiful drive around the Gulf of Corinth, down into the Peloponnese, site of the ancient Olympic Games. Completely different mood to almost every other site in Greece. It's flat, it's wooded, it's green, it's sort of Arcadian. There's a sort of peaceful serenity in Olympia, quite unlike mountain craggy Delphi, which is extremely harsh. From Olympia across to Mycenae, which is this extraordinary rock fortress built of huge boulders, which is surprisingly intact given that the Mycenaean civilization was destroyed 1,000 BC, so 3,000 years ago. This is the site which gives birth to some of the key Greek tragedies and was a place of horrendous horror in terms of what humans did to each other. And I think even today you can get a sense in this grim, dark, boulder, claustrophobic place of this is not a place to hang around.
Mm. So, and is that your 8 days?
Epidavros, the great, it's close to Mycenae, is the great amphitheatre the Greeks built. It's huge, and the acoustics are extraordinary. I mean, I think you've been there.
I have.
You can hear a pin dropped in the middle, and it's not as big as the MCG, but it's sort of getting to that size. You can hear it, the sound, crystal clear in the back row. You can go there one evening with looking out across Greek landscape as the sun goes down and watch a Greek play, a classical Greek play. That's a wonderful experience.
Now, John, I think a lot of Australians, I put myself in this group, I must say, have quite an inferiority about their lack of understanding of the classics. We weren't tutored in the classics, as, say, the English were. Does that matter if people take themselves off and say, well, I will try to do what John's done? Do you need to have read up first?
I think you need some background to what you're doing. You need a good travel guide, but for that Lonely Planet will do the trick. You need some cueing of the story, of the Greek story, and my book's an attempt to do that. If you've got more time, then, and I make recommendations, there are two or three of the Greek tragedies, comedies and Homer that ideally you should read before going.
And you also say that John Ford's The Searchers is, in your mind, is the best reworking of the Homer epic. And I'm actually determined to go out and get that from the video shop if I possibly can, or order it from online.
Yes, the hero story in the West comes out of Homer, and we just do it again. And we do it at Gallipoli, we do it in the American Western, we do it at Trafalgar. Just Homer, it remains the greatest telling of that. It's a sort of archetype that is sort of seeped through, I think, the whole unconscious of the West sense. And one needs to go back to Greece to actually take in this landscape, take in these sites.
Can I just cut through, because there's several things that you take, the whole notion of a redemption, of people making themselves over again, the Achilles story, for instance. You talk about the Parthenon itself is a very interesting. It takes measure to a higher order. Measure becomes a virtue. The temple gives form to a virtue that supersedes morals, or to use Nietzsche's pregnant phrase, you write, goes beyond good and evil. It is a virtue transcendent. Now, tell us, are you sure you're not getting carried away here? about why you would write like that.
Well, the preeminent influence of the Parthenon I go to Las Vegas today, the biggest sort of holiday resort in the West. The main casino there's Caesar's Palace. Caesar's Palace is an American copy of a Roman copy of the Parthenon. It sets an ideal. It sets an ideal of perfect proportion, of that humans can build these perfectly proportioned buildings, just as they can enact perfectly proportioned dances, sporting feats. It sets this ideal of I think this is really Greek religion at its core, that if you want the religious experience, don't go and pray in a church. If you want religious experience, it's through what we humans, during our mortal lives, can create in perfect forms. And the Parthenon's the sort of presiding sort of exemplar of that belief.
But then, and contrasting with the city below and around, a dingy, grubby, sprawling mess, now as then, and I have witnessed that. How do you make sense of that?
I think the modern Greece is just totally intimidated by the Parthenon. I mean, how can you live? I mean, the society is semi-dysfunctional, as we all know today, and you've only got to go to Athens to sort of just be shocked at the disjunction between what's beneath and the sort of decaying concrete and that beautiful gleaming marble up above. I mean, how do you live under... Our ancestors created something so perfect, so great, so brilliant. What's there left for us to do? It's very difficult. It's intimidating.
But nevertheless, you, if I read this book, which has a great deal of depth in it and things to ponder, you talk about the tension between this sort of superb balance, as represented by the Parthenon, and the Erechtheion, its opposite number, its opposite building with its sort of caryatid, screaming women, statues, which, so that life is a mixture of both the great aspirations and the grubby reality.
Yes, I'm putting a grand theory of culture based on the Acropolis with the two buildings, this sort of perfect sublime ideal, the Parthenon, and the other building on top is the Erechtheion, which is dominated, I think, for anyone who goes there by these sculptures of six maidens, larger than life sculptures of six maidens, the Caryatids, who are sort of dark, brooding, bad-tempered. They emanate this sense that, you know, don't get too carried away by the Parthenon, that there are dark, mysterious, fated things in human life. And we represent truths that are deep and profound in the way that the Parthenon is not.
John Carroll, thank you very much indeed for taking us on this rather unusual travelogue.
My pleasure, Geraldine.
And just a snapshot of his travelogue too. You must go and have a look at Greek Pilgrimage in Search of the Foundations of the West. It's light and deep, and you'll enjoy it. It's a scribe book. My thanks to the team, Julie Browning, Sarah Konofsky, Hagar Cohen, and the remarkably cool and equable Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. We've had studios falling down all around us today, and she's coped. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye for now, 9 o'clock.